you're listening to a podcast by definition, and the podcast is called Terrifying Questions and How Not to Be Terrified by Them. And we're here, your hosts, Eric Kaplan and Taylor Carmen.
Hi.
So I have the terrifying question for this week, Taylor, but okay. What I was wondering is, am I just more terrified than you are? Am I a more of a scaredy cat?
That same thought occurred to me. You may be. I have plenty of anxiety, but philosophy has always felt to me kind of comforting and reassuring. And so I don't experience philosophy as a source of anxiety.
It doesn't terrify you. Okay.
So, yeah, there may be a difference of temperament and
maybe we have different
attitude.
Temperaments.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Maybe our... maybe the way and the time in our lives when we hooked up philosophy with our emotions is slightly different. I feel like I'm projecting or connecting a lot of early childhood fear and anxiety onto philosophy.
To me, it was different. It really felt like it was kind of liberating discovery that you could think about this stuff and it was fun.
Well, that's what we're going to bring to the listener.
Yeah.
But I'm going to start with another terrifying question. And this one, when you first hear it, you think, oh, no big deal. But I think if you think about it, you can allow yourself to be quite emotionally upset by it.
Okay.
So here's what I wanted to talk about. Here's the disquieting, terrifying question that I had. And it was like that all the interesting questions in life, you can't talk about them in any meaningful way with anybody else.
Hmm.
And here's the argument. Hmm. That either they're science, mm-hmm. in which case it's not an interesting conversation. You just need to figure out how many brain cells a fly has or, you know, what whether light is actually a particle or a wave. But it's not, in a certain sense, it's not interesting and it's not personal.
Right.
It's just something that go to the lab, take the readings, and we'll do it. So it's almost something that could as easily be done by an algorithm as by a person. So we can't talk about that in any kind of soul-satisfying way.
Right.
And then the other stuff, there's no way to reach an agreement about it. So it's pointless to talk about it.
I see.
So there's no meaningful communication about anything important that anybody can have with anybody. And this makes me sad, and I hope it's not true.
Yeah. So you said we'll never come to an agreement about it. You might think that's true, but you also were saying something much more pessimistic, which is we can't even communicate about it. Like we're kind of talking past each other. We're not even understanding each other somehow. Is that what?
Yeah, I think so. Or I think, well, here's the thing that worries me. Talking about it is futile.
Yeah, yeah.
And whether the futility is the form of, hey, I understand exactly what you mean, but I don't care because nothing you say will ever change my mind. That's one flavor of futility.
Yeah.
And the other one is I have no idea what the heck you're talking about. That's another flavor of futility. I don't have a horse in the race as to which flavor of futility is the real cause of it.
Yeah.
But what worries me is that communication is futile.
Yeah.
That we'll never have important conversations about anything. And by the way, I don't think it's true. I just haven't figured out a intellectually clear way to explain to myself why it's not true. So I don't really think I am having a good conversation with you right now.
I don't
honestly think it's true.
Yep.
But I don't understand why it's not true. And that's the start of ladies and gentlemen of this podcast.
Yes. I share this thought, and it's definitely unsettling, and I think it should be taken very seriously. So I just want to emphasize this distinction between, so there's actually several, there's even maybe three possibilities,
more
distinctions. So the one, I gave you two, which is coming to an agreement about like the truth, and the other was just...
That's why you're a distinguished professor.
Because I distinguish things from each other.
You distinguish things, yes. No, you're distinguishing and distinguished. Anyway, go on.
So I was giving you the choice between we're never going to come to an agreement about like the truth of the matter, and on the other hand, just that we can't even understand what each other is saying.
Yes.
But there's something in between those, and probably several things in between them. One is what the Germans, like Gadamer talks about, a Verständigung.
A Verständigung.
Yeah, which is an understanding that we come to an understanding. It is a kind of agreement, but it's more more like a sort of a practical agreement, or like when you feel like you are communicating and there's some kind of shared ground, even if you're disagreeing about something. So, yeah, I have a worry that maybe that's an illusion. We sort of get a good feeling that we've come to some kind of understanding, but we're still basically caught in our own idiosyncratic, subjective sort of preferences and tastes, and we can't help but think we're converging on some kind of truth, like what's really beautiful, what's really worthwhile, what's really noble or admirable. But really, we're just kind of spinning out our sort of preferences as they change and throughout. And then I also worry about it at this historical level, too, that like you look at all the different tastes of different people at different times in history and you think, we're not converging on anything. I mean, we're just spinning our wheels and
maybe.
But at a personal level, if you really do get into disagreements with people about stuff that you think really matters, it can be really upsetting.
So here's a question that troubled me, and these are all related, because it's all one, man. But these ones are actually related, which is like, why do I want my friends to like the same movies I do?
Yeah, good question. Right. Why should it matter? Yeah.
Why do I care? If I've seen a movie and I've liked it,
and then
you say, nah, I don't like it, why does that bug me?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think we've probably all experienced that. If I want to show something to somebody and I play it for them and they go, it's kind of insulting. You know, I feel threatened by it somehow, or insulted or disrespected.
Right.
But I know that when somebody shows something to me or plays me something, some piece of music, and I also want to be honest with them about what I think about it.
We're going to come back. We're going to come back after a message, I guess, from our algorithmically generated sponsors or something like that. But not only are we going to talk about this movie question, but I want to broaden it because it seems to me that that movie thing might also be a dimension along which we evaluate our whole lives.
Mm-hmm.
And you would kind of want, if you're sharing your life with people, to be kind of on the same page about it to some degree. Anyway, but first, this word from our sponsors. Well, we're back, and we take no moral position on whether you need to purchase the product that was advertised to you just now. But we're happy if you listen
to
it.
We don't even know what it was.
Well, okay, that's true. That's true. So we were talking about this question: why do we care if other people like the same art that we do? But it's a way into a kind of a deeper and maybe harder to express question, which is, why do we care that other people have the same take on life as we do? And what a take on life is, I'll just sort of put a pin in that. That's a good question, but let's not talk about that right now. But I want to focus on the why do we care that it be shared?
So
you had a heavy hitter that you suggested we talk about. Do you want to unfurl him?
Yeah, right. So the philosopher who I think talks most about this, at least in a really deep and original way, is Immanuel Kant.
Who was that?
He was a German philosopher who was writing mostly at the very end of the, last third or so of the 18th century, and really turned philosophy around. So people talk about post-Kantian philosophy, and it's sort of, he's the watershed between what we call early modern and later modern philosophy. He wrote the Critique of Pure Reason and the Critique of Practical Reason and the Critique of Judgment, three big masterpieces, which is like, a hat trick or something, three biggies. And in the Critique of Judgment, he's thinking about aesthetic judgment, which means judgments of the beautiful and the sublime. And he thinks there's a very interesting and kind of undeniable connection of some kind between our aesthetic judgments and our moral judgments. And I think what he had in view is just this phenomenon of like when somebody really disagrees with you about what's beautiful, you can't help but think they're not seeing something or they're missing something or getting something wrong. And there's something wrong with them or there's something wrong with their judgment. But why should we make that connection? Because Kant thought that aesthetics and ethics were about really completely different things. He didn't want to actually mix them up together and identify them because morality is one kind of thing. He thought it was perfectly objective, what's morally right and wrong.
but it's subjective what seems to you beautiful and what pleases you aesthetically. So why is there this connection between them, and what can possibly explain that?
So many people nowadays on Twitter and in the culture at large are worried about the issue of canceling the wicked artist. It's kind of on the side where he says, yes, artist Joe is a child molester who makes hats out of baby's ears, but he writes beautiful music. Who cares?
It's hard to know exactly what he would say about that, but I think he would say this, that our judgments about the morality of the person's actions or character are of a completely different nature from our judgments about the artistic worth or aesthetic qualities of the artworks. And the reason he drew a sharp line was because he didn't want you to think that by pursuing beauty and getting pleasure from it, you were doing something morally virtuous.
There's a, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this phrase correctly, the bien pensant position on literature. Literature is good because it broadens your understanding of the sphere of people that you can empathize with. And it's good for you because when you read it, you used to think that, I don't know, you used to think the child molesters were just jerks, but now you've read Lolita and you're I can understand those poor child molesters. And Kant thinks this position is wrong. Is that right?
Well, this is where it gets tricky. See, because his solution to this problem about, I'll phrase the problem the way he phrased it, which is, it's clear, he thought, that our aesthetic judgments are subjective because they're just about the way things affect me or you.
My taste. He says it's my taste.
That's right. They are subjective. But we don't just leave it there, like you were saying before. Like, why don't we just say, okay, so I like it and you don't. Who cares? What's the difference? Because he thinks that our aesthetic judgments are also binding or normative, that we presume, and even in one translation, demand that other people agree with us. So he does think that we almost can't help but see these aesthetic disagreements as having some kind of moral import or moral significance, even though they don't literally coincide with our moral judgments. So what were you asking me if he rejects the view that
literature is good?
Yes. Oh, I see.
Because of the job it does expanding our moral understanding of other people.
Let me put in one more scholarly footnote. I'll try to not do too much of this, but that is the view, and Kant definitely rejected that. That's the view of Friedrich Schiller. So Schiller wrote in also the 1790s, Aesthetic Letters on the Education of Mankind, in which he thought that aesthetic education really would get us closer to moral virtue and happiness, these morally worthy things. So I think Schiller would be much more sympathetic to that idea that literature, the experience of beauty, actually is morally edifying. Now, Kant thought that was very dangerous.
And Schiller is less important than Kant. We don't talk about post-Schillerian.
Sure. No, we don't. But he was a very good poet, maybe not one of the great, great poets. He was a very good poet. He wasn't a great philosopher, but it's an interesting idea. It's a very important
text. This is just a nerd question. Yeah. Do you think that John Quincy Adams had read The Critique of Pure Reason?
I have no idea. I know so little about John Quincy Adams.
I'm just curious whether the American founding fathers, who were Enlightenment philosophes, were they paying attention to Kant at all?
I doubt it. I mean, somebody will have to check me on this, but I doubt that Kant was making much of an impression in America until the end of the 19th century. But that's just my guess. I think they were Enlightenment philosophes. They were interested in the French thinkers.
Not Kant, this.
Yeah, see, Kant wrote this essay called What is Enlightenment, which is very interesting. But it's very hard to place Kant in this sort of Enlightenment, anti-Enlightenment divide. If you put a gun to my head and said, which camp does he belong in, I'd say Enlightenment. But he's really not like the other thinkers in all kinds of ways.
He brooms back reason to make room for faith, which sounds like a very anti-Enlightenment project to me.
Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah, I think that's right. And so anyway, Schiller would have liked that view you're talking about.
But Kant,
art opens your mind and in a morally beneficial way. So we ought to sort of pursue what he called an aesthetic education. You ought to give this to people because it'll help them be morally better. Kant definitely rejected that.
So let's lay out the Kantian position, because I agree with you. I think it's really deep and it's very cool.
Yeah, it's very subtle. Right. So moral judgments are objective. aesthetic judgments are subjective, but that's not the end of the story. Because and here's this phenomenon of when you disagree with somebody about a movie or something, and a disagreement emerges, it's disturbing, and maybe it's even threatening, because you might think, "Man, can I be so wrong about this?" And then you might dig in your head, "I'm not wrong. I'm the other person's wrong." And so it's almost like you're acting as if these are objective judgments, but now Kant thinks they're just not, and you're never going to get any satisfaction. You know, try to prove that this thing is beautiful, the way you prove. What was your example about the number of
how many cells are in the brain of a fly? Yeah,
exactly. Right. So there's an answer to that. You can, in principle, get the answer. But there's just no way to point to something and say, aha, that's beautiful, QED. And now you just have to admit it, because somebody could say, I don't see what you see in this. And anyway, so where does that come from? That
can
sort
you
of
well, hang on a second. Normative demand. I just want to understand the premise before I get into his answer.
Good.
Like, supposing you're playing the game Baroque music, and perhaps you could never convince someone to play the game of Baroque music. But assuming we're on board that we're the Baroque music society of Encino, did he think you could not convince someone that Bach is better than Clementi?
If they really didn't think so. Yeah, that's basically it. Because you could say, look how much more sophisticated Bach is, or look how much more complex, and look how many more variations there are. And the person could say, yeah, that's all complexity, but these other pieces are just more beautiful. Huh. They just, you know, they move me. You're right to point out that example, because it's hard to imagine somebody, if they really listen to the music, thinking that. But there's plenty of other cases in which people continue to disagree about, I don't know, Faulkner versus Hemingway, or Tolstoy versus Dostoevsky, or something like this. They can't agree about what the criteria are. So
right.
The criteria that seem pretty objective are usually the ones that presuppose an agreement about what we're trying to achieve. And then you can say, this does it better than that one. But there's got to be a lot of common ground already there in order for those comparisons to even be made. But think of the way different generations' taste changes. So, for example, Bach was not as famous as his children in his own day. And his kids, like C.P.E. Bach, they were more famous than Bach was, because by the time Bach has died, classical music is starting to appear. And that seems to everybody sort of obviously better. And Bach looked old-fashioned and fuddy-duddy, and it was a long time before people started appreciating Johann Sebastian Bach. Or another example is French music was also very hostile, what's called the Italian style, until, again, the end of the 18th century. So what I mean is that it's kind of shocking, but people thought Shakespeare was violating rules of tragedy throughout the 18th century, because he wasn't writing plays like Racine and Corneille. Yeah,
Corneille.
They had rules like this, you know, and they thought it's clear that Shakespeare wasn't onto them and was violating the rules, and that's why his plays are inferior. So a lot of those technical rules within a kind of style can, with historical distance, look very parochial and scholastic and kind of irrelevant to the aesthetic judgment, after all.
I guess what, and I don't want to, because I feel like I'm getting away from like the chase, but it does strike me that, like, nobody thinks that Tamerlane is better than Hamlet. I believe that some people think that Molière is better than Hamlet, but nobody thinks that Tamerlane is. So
I guess,
like, you could say, I like the Ramones, or I don't like the Ramones, I like the Beatles. But if you're going to like punk rock, you're going to like the Ramones and not the crappy band that the other people in high school with the Ramones were doing too. That's just like the Ramones, but bad. And I don't know.
Well, here's the thing is, it's tempting to try to get some comfort around this terrifying question by pointing to all the cases in which we seem to agree.
Right.
And doesn't that mean there's something objective or something solid? But here's the terrifying thought about that. So in the case where we agree, so what? I mean, that's an accident of coincidence of preferences. And maybe that's still kind of meaningless, because it's like, maybe that just means in some lucky cases we agree, in a lot of cases we don't. But the really disturbing thought is that, you know, it's just a matter of luck that we sometimes agree. And and so maybe it doesn't actually mean anything about that there's really solid ground here. It just means that, yeah, those are the easy cases.
Right.
But the hard cases are the ones where these disagreements open up, and maybe even these abysses of disagreement. And maybe it's like finally one generation dies off so that their tastes can sort of go on the scrap heap. But maybe, you know, I think in a lot of cases, maybe they were onto something we've lost and we can't appreciate anymore, because it's easy to point out, you know, Hamlet, Bach, and, you know, and that's one wants to do that. But what are we really doing by pointing to the cases of convergence and agreement, except just saying, it wouldn't it be nice if there were more cases like this?
Okay, so let's get clear again what the problem is,
yeah,
so that we can have some sense of whether we're making a move towards solving it. The yeah. problem is that judgments of taste are confessions of how things are going with me. They're really yeah. about how it strikes me. They're in a sense a little bit like falling in love. Yeah. When I fall in love mm-hmm. with somebody, I've fallen in love with them. And it's I'm the one who's fallen in love. I haven't said everybody ought to fall in love with Sally or, you know, yeah. Bob. I don't want to be heteronormative here. Everyone ought to fall in love with Bob. But I say I love Bob.
Right.
And yet we get angry and upset and scared when people don't share our judgments.
Yeah.
So that's what Kant calls the antinomy of taste. And Mary Mothersill, who I studied with, put it in this way, that she said judgments of taste, and her example was whatever, X is beautiful, you know, mm-hmm. are true or false. But there are no laws of taste that right. take the form. If a certain thing has these qualities, it is beautiful.
Right.
And that's how she formulated it. And I think that's interesting. I think that's right. But
how do we talk about
and I brought up the love thing because I think it's not just about
yeah.
we're shopping for mm-hmm. an Apple playlist. It's sort of
the
deepest level of how we engage with our lives. And yep. why is it that we want to talk about it, but we can't talk about it? Or like, what's yeah. going on, man?
Let me give you, and then let me just sort of underline the disturbingness of the question. Here's the way I kind of get disturbed by it. So when I think what's so nice about aesthetic agreement is that it brings people together.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go to a show and you all love it, it brings you together. So it creates a kind of what we call a Verständigung, a kind of like we're seeing things in the same way and we're sharing it.
Yeah.
And it's really nice. And that's great. And that's maybe art is sort of, you know, really wonderful when it does that. It creates a kind of community feeling. Even it doesn't have to be too many people together, but the more, in a way, the more powerful it is when you realize people all over the world listen to Bach or read Hamlet and you think, wow, isn't that wonderful? I mean, that can do that. But here's the disturbing feeling that maybe that good feeling you have from within that community, it's like being in a family. You look at some alien community that seems to have their own favorite artworks and has their own sort of traditions and rituals, and they look very happy, but it's so alienating because you look at that and you think, wow, I can't identify with that at all. And then doesn't that tend to undermine your confidence in whatever one you've got? You think, wow, but it's very like your falling in love example. Because when you look at other people in love, especially if you're very far removed from them in time or place or custom or tradition or whatever, and you can't imagine yourself into that community, it may be kind of alienating. And you think, wow, I guess they look happy, but I don't know quite why they're so happy. I mean, after all, look at the look at how strange or miserable their lives look from my point of view. I find that very unsettling that can threaten the comfort that you seem to have from within this sense of community, which may, again, just be, now, again, I don't really believe this, but this is the worry, just a kind of myth, a fiction, a kind of illusion of happiness. I mean, when you're depressed, when I'm depressed, like Anna Karenina has this feeling of like looking at other people who seem to be happy, and she has this contempt for them because she thinks, how can you be happy? Mm-hmm. I mean, it just looks like a lie to her, right? I mean, I know that feeling when you think you cannot identify with other people's happiness. So you don't have to go that far. But this is the seed of that kind of problem. Like when we have this aesthetic happiness of creating a sense of community with a great work of art or literature, something like that, you might have this moment of thinking, man, maybe this is no different from any other community that talks itself into liking something together and it gives them a good feeling. But there's nothing true about it. It's totally eccentric. It's totally idiosyncratic. There's nothing to it other than this subjective good feeling. And if they happen to share it, good for them. But it's still not pointing to anything. I find, okay, so that's the problem. That's right. I'm still just stating the problem.
That's the problem. So let me come up with a hopeful way out of this problem.
Yeah.
So there are these two kids, and they grow up in the same apartment building. And it's a rainy day. And one of the kids goes outside and comes to one of those cool vacant lots. And this vacant lot has like old bottles in it and a refrigerator with an ailanthus tree growing out of it and cool broken shit that you don't know what it is exactly. It's sort of nestled in there between these two brick buildings. And he's like, this is so cool. And he goes to his friend and says, hey, come on. Let's take a look at this. And he's like, I don't know. It looks like a lot of garbage. Like, no, it's not a lot of garbage. Look at that. Look at that. Look at that. Look at that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
oh, and then they start playing together in it. the kid number one has communicated something to kid number two.
Mm.
He hasn't forced him to play in the dangerous vacant lot. He's invited him to.
Yeah.
And something about that invitation, I think, is cool. And it's not, it's different from forcing someone to do it and saying, and if you don't do it, you're going to go to jail. But it's also, the kid number one is being vulnerable. He is saying, let's do this together. Let's enjoy this vacant lot together.
Because I think it's cool. Yeah.
Well, or it is cool.
No, I mean, what I mean, I was like, the vulnerability, I thought you meant the vulnerability is like he's putting his sort of taste.
Let's have fun together. Yeah. Like, it's almost like an invitation to like start a new life together. It's let's live our lives together and include this vacant lot together in it. And wouldn't that be nice?
Okay. Can I introduce one more distinction?
Please.
So, and this kind of is another way of underlining the worry. So it might be that what they've just discovered is something they both like and they both enjoy it. And it could be like a kind of food, like, oh, this is really yummy. Here, try this. Oh, yeah, I like it too. Now, that happens all the time and it's fine. But Kant thought, and I think he's right about this, that when it comes to judgments of beauty, these are different kinds of judgments because they're not just judgments about what gives me what he called gratification or satisfaction of pleasure. It's giving me something that I get pleasure from, even if I don't have it or own it or possess it. So it's sort of the difference between enjoying a beautiful landscape and eating a food. You're getting a benefit. You've got an interest in the food because you're benefiting from it. But your judgment, your aesthetic judgment, is what he called disinterested, because it's not that you want to buy the landscape or take it home with you or put a fence around it and own it. It's that you're just enjoying that it's there and for anybody to sort of enjoy. So the one thing about your example, and this is underlines, I think, the anxiety is, well, that's very nice if that happens. But maybe, again, that's just another case of two people happening to like the same thing. And so what? A third person will not like it. And it's good for them because they found something to enjoy together. But it's still not, absolutely not pointing to anything that transcends their subjective idiosyncratic tastes. It's you know, whereas in the case of art, it brings people together, but you really think it points beyond the eccentricity of their own preferences to something larger or deeper or more meaningful. I think Kant was trying to capture that as somehow connected to the quasi-moral significance we sometimes assign to it. Like, there's more to this than just that I happen to like it, or even that you and I both happen to like it. It's that this sort of speaks to us, and anybody who doesn't see how good it is missing it. Is there's something wrong with their judgment. Now, we can't ever justify that objectively, but that's going to go beyond the example, I think, that you're giving. I mean, they would have to, if they found something that they wanted to say was really beautiful, they'd have to be committed to the idea, I think, that more or less anybody ought to see this as beautiful. Whereas there's plenty of things that we do like that. We think, when I say, look, this is not for everybody, but I really like it.
I guess I'm wondering if I'm jumping on board with the Kantian project here. Because this distinction between things that gratify me and things that I'm not interested in, I think I don't really buy.
By the way, it's just so our listeners all understand, disinterested is different from uninterested. So I'm disinterested. That just means I don't have an interest in the sense of an investment, like a judge is disinterested. But of course, it doesn't mean I'm uninterested, like I'm bored by it.
Because it seems a little like kind of sex negative, right?
Sex negative.
Ah. I mean, like if we find a romantic partner, who an erotic object means it means we would like to make love with them and I would hate to say that that's not an aesthetic appreciation.
This was Nietzsche's objection to Kant. Nietzsche just thought, in fact, he said something like, I can't remember how he puts it, but he thought, there's something very chaste and dishonest about this. He thought that Kantian idea of disinterestedness is like as if they've never seen these, you know, paintings of beautiful naked ladies. Everybody knows that there's a erotic drive underlying those aesthetic judgments. And that was his view about this.
I think that might be my view. I mean, but I don't want, I want to give the Kantian position as much strength as I can, because I feel like when you dismiss things too quickly, you don't get the juice out of them.
Yeah.
Let's put a pin in that Nietzschean worry, although I think it's true. but
I don't. So we'll have something to disagree about later. Okay. Yeah. I think there's a real difference between nudes in art and pornography. I think they serve completely different functions. But so
right. I guess one of the things about like saying, why don't I go to the starving person and say, hey, here's this thing, bread. I think you'll like it. It's because everybody knows, like, it's not up for it's not up for discussion. But the whether to spend your time indoors, you know, playing video games or go out and explore this vacant lot, it sort of is up for discussion.
Right. So those two are more like the gratification on the one side, because if one person comes along and tastes the bread and says, yuck, how can you eat this stuff? It's terrible. Hopefully you just shrug your shoulders and say, oh, that's weird. Most people like it. But if you don't, whatever. And how you're going to spend your life maybe almost becomes a quasi moral or at least sort of broadly ethical question, like wasting your time.
Do I really shrug my shoulders at the person?
Not always.
Who doesn't like bread?
No, right. I think
you could be gratifying yourself, dude, and you're not. And, you know, you might even starve to death if all you'll eat is, you know.
Oh, you could criticize them for refusing to eat it because they don't like it, even though they're starving to death. But that would be a really practical sort of disagreement. Like, just, I know it's, you don't like it, fine, but eat it because you need the nutrition. Just whether they happen to, maybe it doesn't taste good to them. When people are sick, food tastes different, and you don't try and persuade them to like it if they don't like it, because, you know.
Right. That's an interesting question about people who are depressed. Like, let's say that the kid in my story is depressed.
Mm. Yeah.
And the first kid is like, go play in the vacant lot. He's like, nah, it looks like crap because everything is crap.
Mm-hmm.
That's too bad. You kind of wish that guy would take some Zoloft or somehow not feel that way.
I think in the case of the aesthetic judgment, though, what you would feel about that person is a certain kind of pity because they can't see the beauty in things.
Yeah.
Putting it that way makes it sound like, look, there is beauty in these things, and it's a sad, it's too bad you can't see it. If you weren't depressed, maybe you would see it, because it's there to be seen. That's the seemingly objective but not really objective quality of these judgments. Like, the beauty is there. It's like, I think people who don't like, I don't know, Bach, Mozart, or Shakespeare, or Dostoevsky, or all the kinds of things I think are really great, I think it's unfortunate. They're missing out. They don't know what they're missing.
I agree.
Because it doesn't matter, you know, in the same way that it matters if they're sick, this food just won't taste good to them. I think they're kind of, blameworthy is too strong a word, but I think it's up to them to be able to see the beauty of it. They ought to see it. That's what I'm saying. They ought to. That's the ought. That's the source of the problem for Kant. There's an ought there that he doesn't know where it comes from.
Where does it come from?
So he's got two different answers. Yeah.
Well, we're going to come back after another break from our sponsors, and we're going to discuss where the ought comes from. Why ought we to love the lovable and find the beautiful to be beautiful, and even to find the sublimely terrifying punk rock kick in your ass thing.
Yeah.
Punk rock and kick in your ass. Okay. Right. So we're going to listen to this. Why not? Okay. Well, you listen to that. And now we're going to talk about where the ought comes from in aesthetic judgments. And again, it's not just about art, guys. I really think it's sort of about a dimension of our lives that pulses behind each moment. Anyway,
I agree. Yeah. Okay. So the interesting thing about the critique of judgment, the first half of it about aesthetic judgments, is that Kant solves this problem in two different ways, which might indicate that he didn't think the first solution was a solution, which I agree with. Mm-hmm. So the first solution, I'll mention it quickly. I'm going to have to dwell on it because it sounds like a non-starter. The solution is that he thinks that we all have a kind of shared sensibility. It's called the sensus communis, or the common sense.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes that expression is used to mean like the sense that pulls all the five senses together into one experience. But he also thinks something like that is presupposed. We presume that everybody's got that.
Well, is that related to he ain't got no common sense?
Well, you might think common sense is a kind of judgment. Maybe it's similar to aesthetic judgment in a way. Kant did draw this distinction between understanding and judgment. So understanding is like intellect, and judgment is like good sense. So my grandfather, who I never really knew, apparently used to sometimes refer to people as all brains and no sense. And it's a real phenomenon. I mean, people can be super, super, super clever, and they make the worst judgments. You can't imagine how they could be so, in some sense, fools. I mean, you can be very, very smart and a fool. Anyway, so I think he was onto that distinction. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's got something in common with common sense, but it can also mean common to the five senses.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, Kant thinks, since we just suppose, we don't know it empirically, but we suppose Because it's a kind of presupposition of our ability to communicate with each other, that we all share that. And that means that when something strikes my eye and stimulates my imagination in this way that gives me the sense of the beautiful, it ought to happen. That ought to happen to you too. And when it doesn't, I'm perplexed and disturbed.
Is this an example of that, that like humans have a circulatory system and we have a heartbeat. And if you listen to rhythm that's faster than the heartbeat, it's fast. And if you listen to rhythm that's slower than the heartbeat, it's slow. And that's because we're all, and if we were talking to intelligent music critics who were humpback whales, it would be different. And in fact, it is different, because if you listen to their music, it's not very enjoyable to
right,
us.
But it better not just be that, because that puts us right back where we started, sort of like if somebody else doesn't have the same kind of sensory apparatus and imagination that I do, why don't we just shrug our shoulders and say, okay, well,
the whale, the intelligent whale doesn't like my podcast.
There's lots of videos on YouTube with somebody playing a piano and there's elephants sort of standing around listening or cat, or you play a French horn and suddenly along the cows come and people love to say, oh, look how they're enjoying the music. And I have to say, I've looked at those and I can't see that they're enjoying the music. I can see that they're curious or that it just attracts them like a magnet. But cats and dogs, I don't know if you've ever played a musical instrument for a cat or a dog at your house. I see no evidence at all that they're even hearing what we hear. You don't blame the dog or the cat.
No, I just don't think,
you know, they're made differently. So here's the problem with Kant's first solution is that it sounds like it's just a kind of assumption that we're all made in the similar enough way that we ought to expect that people will disagree with us. But what Kant says is there's more than expectation of agreement. There's demand for agreement. I've always thought this doesn't seem to really answer the ought question. It doesn't say why others ought to agree with you. It just says they probably will, but that's not what we need. So he's got a second answer, which is more interesting.
And by the way, I really give props to him for doing all this in the age before the electric light. Can you imagine being up like by a candle writing this
stuff?
Oh,
my God.
Anyway, go on.
Back then. Yeah, exactly.
Very,
right.
Very good job, ancestors. Anyway, go on.
Okay, so the second answer he gives, very different, which is we were sort of skirting around it earlier. Kant thinks that we experience the beautiful as what he calls a symbol of the morally good. So it's not evidence of the morally good or in any way objectively tied to the morally good, because people who are moral monsters can have very good aesthetic taste. People who have terrible aesthetic taste can be morally pure. Kant knew that. So you can't actually infer back and forth. This goes back to maybe the Lolita example. People's aesthetic judgments and their moral judgments actually don't have to have anything really, any consistency in real life. We all know this from experience. I mean, I think Kant thinks. But there's a symbolic relationship between them. And what he meant by that was that when you experience something beautiful, he thinks you see it as a kind of promise that the world is conducive to our moral aspirations. Like the world has made room for our sensibility, our imaginations. There's beauty out there in the world, so it seems, even though it's not objectively there. Physics won't discover it, but it's there. And that seems to give you a kind of promise that the world is welcoming of our own sort of moral aspirations and emotions and commitments and so on. And that's a promise that's very valuable because it makes you have hope that the world won't just be completely indifferent or hostile to our moral aims and purposes. And that's why we're so attached to it. That's why it's not just a kind of arbitrary preference. It's really a kind of promise of moral success, like that things won't just end in failure and misery, and there'll be some happiness that goes along with moral virtue. But it's merely a promise that's kind of symbolic. I don't know if there's any real argument. It's a kind of phenomenology. I think he's appealing to what he thinks is contained in these aesthetic judgments, that they have this moral import. And that's what the moral import seems to be, that we seem to think there's something morally intimated in this experience of beauty. And that is, by the way, what inspired Schiller to write the aesthetic letters, because he read the Third Critique and then said, yes, in fact, they're really tied together in fact. And then Kant said, no, they're not actually objectively tied together, but we can't help but see the one as a promise or a symbolic kind of intimation of the other.
Well, I think that's beautiful.
I
think it's a beautiful answer.
Yeah, it's very powerful. Yeah,
because it strikes me that some consequences fall out pretty nicely, which is that the person who doesn't like the movie and the person who doesn't want to play in the vacant lot is refusing to respond to a promise of happiness and goodness.
Right.
And that explains our emotional response to such a person. because they're like, they're lacking in hope.
Yeah, but it's stronger. It's stronger or maybe narrower than that, because they're not just foregoing an experience that would be gratifying to them again. Mm-hmm. They are rejecting a promise of a not any old happiness, but the kind of happiness that goes along with moral virtue.
Right.
The kind of happiness that you could be worthy of having, not just that you happen to be lucky and have because like you won the lottery. So there's more to it. And I think the extra oomph there, the ought, comes from this is not a happiness that you could just have and you're foregoing it. And that means you're making a mistake. But this is a kind of happiness you ought to aspire to, because it's the happiness that should be paired to something really, Kant would say, morally valuable. Really valuable, actually valuable.
So there's something there's something chilling about the Philistine. There's something chilling about the person who's like, I don't see that movie as beautiful. What was the box office on that movie?
Right.
And that Philistine is unwilling to come along with us to believe that there could be a world where people treat each other fairly and with love and are happy. That person thinks that that's a bunch of bullshit.
Right.
And that's why that person is an upsetting person to encounter.
That's why it's especially threatening to have somebody attack your taste by saying, oh, that's just sentimental. Because I think we all think that some art tips over to the point of being sentimental, saccharine, and tasteless and kitsch. And we all at some point draw the line. But if you tell somebody else, you think, ah, that's just sentimental, they experience it. Like I experience it sometimes if I like something and somebody says, oh, how can you like that? It's like a Hallmark card. It's like, ugh, so sentimental. And then I think this person lacks compassion. Uh-huh. This person doesn't have the moral feeling that's somehow stirred up by this work of art. So that's the temptation. Now, again, Kant thought it was a big mistake to think that you know that the person who judges that to be worthless or a bunch of bullshit or sentimental, you know, saccharine, whatever, it's a big mistake to think that person actually is lacking anything moral. But I think it's hard not to think this person really lacks some kind of humane sensibility or sensitivity that's very important to have.
Well, exactly. I think the way in which people differ on let me focus this with an example. So let's say we're writing a movie, and the movie is about a woman who's a victim of an evil conspiracy. And the bad guys are telling lies about her, and she's losing her children, and she's losing her job. Mm. And yet we feel for her. So this is an example of how, if this is a beautiful movie about an unfortunate woman, but the way we're told this story, it breaks our heart. We're not just like laughing at her being ground down or thinking, I'd like to invest in that conspiracy. It seems like it's pretty good. No, we feel it's beautiful. So this is a symbol of how even if you lose everything in the world, still you can have a worthwhile life. And that's sort of a symbol of what good is. And then the sentimental artist. So it's a promise. It's a promise that we could perhaps create such a world if we really try and we're courageous and, you know, keep going. So that's the beauty is a symbol of goodness, promise of goodness. Then the sentimentalist is the one who ends that movie by having her win the lottery. And then other people are like, well, come on, you're cheating. That's not, we can't promise that everyone is going to win the lottery. By nature, lotteries, only a few people win lotteries.
I see. But you don't actually have to say anything implausible in order for it already to be sentimental.
So what makes it sentimental?
Because that story could have been sentimental from the very beginning. As soon as the violins come in and there's soft glow and the camera light and you see the tear trickling down her cheek and you know you're being manipulated. You know that the filmmaker is trying to press your buttons and get, and as soon as you think that they're sort of trying to telegraph the emotion you ought to have, you resent it and you say, that's emotionally manipulative sentimental.
Now, why
I don't like it.
Why do some people think that a promise of happiness is manipulative and other people are okay?
Because it's not a sincere promise. It's like cheating.
It's cheating.
Remember, in your case, the promise is very explicit in the narrative arc of the story, but Kant means anything beautiful, like a flower.
Uh-huh.
Or, you know, even, you know, a little line in a Mozart sonata, just that sort of nice thing that you might think it's just and Kant does sort of think it's just a shape after all. It's just a shape of tone or noise or harmony. And even that is a promise. if it's beautiful, it's not just something you want to eat.
Now, how does, let's say that that's beautiful from, I think, what's that from the Marriage of Figaro or from Mozart.
It sounds like Mozart.
How would that be different to make it insincere? How can a sequence of music notes be insincere?
Oh, listen to Muzak and elevator music and lots of strings and melodies that are very simple and are very clearly meant to sort of be tearjerkers. There's plenty of that stuff.
But why is it insincere?
You just can't stand it.
But why is it insincere to write?
I don't
buy the easiness thing, because imagine that we all get a cognitive upgrade thanks to something from Eli Lilly. And everything that was hard is now easy for us because we're so much smarter. That can't be the difference.
Let me explain what I mean. I didn't mean it was easy to write or play, because some things that are very easy to write or play are beautiful. But I guess what I meant was it's easy. What did I mean? It's easy in the sense that I don't feel like it's really earned somehow. It seems too calculated and designed just to evoke a certain kind of subjective response. And then again, I feel like I'm being manipulated or massaged to react some way. Whereas when I hear the thing is beautiful, it's very hard to describe this. It's a very good question you're asking. Like, what is this experience of genuineness in a melody or a piece of music that really seems like it points to something rather than it's just trying to push my buttons? And here's the place where people really disagree. Like, a lot of sort of classical music snobs didn't like Tchaikovsky because the melodies just seemed too accessible and it was sort of too easy emotionally. I think they've more or less been outvoted on this, but maybe not everybody. Maybe some people think that's crass compared to.
Well, you know, those people will not accept a headcount as a way of determining it. That seems to be built into their critique. Yeah,
no, this is another thing that Kant calls the autonomy of aesthetic judgment. If you're really making an aesthetic judgment, you cannot really think something is beautiful. You can't accept that it's beautiful just because that's what other people think. You have to make the judgment yourself. So even if I'm the only one in the world who thinks this thing is beautiful, if it's really beautiful, I should stick to my guns. I mean, right.
I think we may call it.
Yeah.
I would like the listeners, if you're the only one in the world who thinks that this podcast is beautiful, stick to your guns.
please keep listening.
Keep listening. Okay, that's good. And also, a possible promise of happiness for a future episode, I would like to discuss, is all emotional interaction manipulation?
I hope not.
Hope not, too. It's a scary, it's disquieting. It's unheimlich. Okay. So we've come to the end of this issue, and it took us back to 18th century Königsberg. But what did we come up with an answer? Question again was, is there anything worth talking about that's not either entirely up to each person's blind taste or a scientific question to be answered in laboratories by advanced computers? Meaningful and human that people can talk about? And what was the answer?
So the kind of thing that Kant called aesthetic judgments, which I actually think extends through all kinds of human endeavors in the humanities and all sorts of areas, not just sort of the appreciation of art, really are not just simply objective or subjective. They aren't fully objective like scientific questions, but they're not matters of mere preference or opinion. They really kind of point to something deep and important about how to live and what's important and what's meaningful to us in a shared kind of way. So there is this middle third area of discourse and thought which concerns stuff which is perfectly real in one way and really matters to us. And Kant, I think, saw that, and I think I agree with him.
Kant saw that. Taylor thinks that. I think that, too. I hope you all think that, because then that means that this this podcast is a step towards that. We're all talking about something that we care about, and it's not a waste of time. So cool.
We have a sensus communis.
Yeah, sensus communis. Okay, definitely. Thanks for listening, everybody. You guys are great. You could have listened to something else, and instead you listened to this. Thank you.
You stuck it out and tolerated the terror and unsettling.
Right, and are stronger because of it. Okay, thanks. Uncanniness. Excellent. Yeah, okay. From the uncanny valley to the uncanny mountain. Okay,
bye-bye. Okay. Bye.
This podcast is created by Eric Kaplan and Taylor Carman, produced by Amanda Eberhardt, and edited by Taylor Carman.